The sanctity of life is what we're talking about today. What does it even mean? What is sanctity? And I've just come up with a couple of words, and you can see them on the screen there. Holy, precious. It's something that God has given us that is extremely valuable. It's something not to be taken lightly. But I'm also really aware, before we start, it's a really sensitive issue, and the chances are that this will have touched your lives in one way or another, maybe directly, maybe indirectly. But I might trip over my words, and I might use phrasing that's not very helpful. And if I do, it's not my intention. So please hear that now. And if I do say something that you struggle with, come talk to me. That's absolutely fine. My desire today is that we hear the heart of God. That was very clear to me when I first started thinking about this in the summer. To make his ways known, his designs for us, and how to respond in a broken world, the one that we live in. And ultimately, to remind us that there's hope and there's forgiveness in Jesus. And that might be something that you need to hear today. Okay, so the structure of today, just so you know where I'm going, it is a bit long, and I'm hoping I don't bore you. I'll try and go as fast as I can and keep it clear. So what things do we think of when we think sanctity of life? What are those big issues? So we'll look at a couple of those, and we'll set the scene. Then I'm going to look at the lenses that we might look through. How does society approach these issues? We'll look at the dominant worldview, a secular worldview. We'll unpack a little bit of what that is. And then we'll look at a biblical worldview and how we view it. Some clues as to how we might respond there in godly perspective. And then lastly, we'll look at how can we respond. And we've just got a couple of little headings to help us remember some things there. Okay. So this might be a little heavy, this next bit, but we'll go for it anyway. One of the first things you might have thought of when I said sanctity of life, the value of life, those issues might have been crisis pregnancy and abortion. And certainly it's one of the things I first think of. It's that medical process of ending a pregnancy so that there won't be a child at the end of that. And the law in our land is that this is legal for up to 24 weeks of a pregnancy. So that's more than halfway through. And there are criteria to be able to have an abortion. So it's got to be a situation where it might cause harm to the mother, physically or mentally, or to her children, her existing family. Or it might be the risk of a severe abnormality in the baby that is growing. And just interestingly, Northern Ireland actually adopted our law in October, so just a month ago, sadly, they became part of our world. Statistics-wise, I'm going to turn around because I haven't written these down. It's a lot on a page, but over 200,000 abortions in England, Wales and Scotland, so that will change because Ireland will now be included in that. 9 out of 10 within the first 13 weeks, so it's early, but doesn't necessarily make any difference. Only 2% due to severe mental or physical handicap of the child, that is. So that's only a very small proportion. Almost all are funded by the NHS, and importantly, that last point, it's consistently in psychology, in the world of psychology, in their research, consistently associated with elevated rates of mental health issues. And I know Siobhan touched on mental health for us a few weeks ago, so that's not made up, that's a fact in that sense. Okay. Another thing that you might think of when we think big issues is embryo research. You might think of words like designer babies and stem cells and all of those kinds of things that we pretend to understand but we don't really. Embryo research is altering the genetic information in that embryo. Why would we do that? Well, we want to understand development of the embryo, development of a baby. That would be one of the arguments. Another argument might be, well, we can maybe tackle some inherited conditions. If we alter the genes in the DNA, then we might be able to tackle some of those inherited conditions and rule them out, which sounds good. But where do we get those embryos from? Well, they're often created, well, they are created in an IVF cycle. So they're in vitro fertilization, and that's a medical treatment for couples who are struggling to get pregnant naturally, to conceive naturally. So we would take an egg from the woman and a sperm from the man, and we'd mix them in a dish. In vitro, we call that, because it's not in the woman. And then we create embryos. And then we would put an embryo back in the woman to grow and be a pregnancy. And then the ones that are left over, the surplus embryos, what do we do with those? And that's where this might come in as an option, embryo research. Okay, law-wise, it is legal in the UK under the 1990 Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act. But it's only legal in vitro, so in a dish outside the body. We're not talking about working on embryos in a woman. And it's only legal in the first 14 days. So that's where we stand. Finally, right at the other end of the spectrum, I'm going to mention one more, euthanasia and assisted suicide or assisted dying. Euthanasia, deliberately ending someone's life to relieve their suffering. Okay. Assisted suicide is what it says. It's assisting someone to end their own life to relieve their suffering. And some people like to clarify with assisted dying that they will assist someone who's already dying. Okay. And the law in our land, it's illegal here. But there are many other countries and several states in the US where this isn't an illegal thing. In our country, euthanasia is classed as murder or manslaughter, and assisted suicide, maybe up to 14 years in prison for being involved. And so the statistics, 24 people last year went over to Dignitas. You might have heard that. That's a clinic in Switzerland. A few people went there to end their lives with as much dignity as possible. 300 dying people chose to end their own lives at home, unsupported. 82% of the public support a change in our law. And similarly, GP polls, 77% support a change. And palliative care doctors, those who already work with those who are terminally ill, so they're really concerned with symptom control, 82% are still in favour of changes to our law. But interestingly, MPs rejected a change to the law in 2015, which is great. So I'm not going to answer all these questions, but here's a few of the challenges. How can we choose between one life over another in an abortion sort of situation where someone is considering ending a pregnancy? Is it really a woman's right to choose? Is it about autonomy? Is anyone else involved? What are we saying about the value of life when someone is disabled, when there are severe abnormalities? What about the long-term impact? When does life begin anyway? And what makes us human? In relation to euthanasia, is it a right to die issue? If sickness wasn't God's original plan, though, should we have a better response? Is it compassionate to let people suffer? What's the right, the loving thing to do? And how do we support the loved ones of those who are suffering? So as I said, I'm not answering all those questions today, but I hope you brought your packed lunches. Okay, moving on then to the lenses. I'm aware this sounds a little bit teachy, but it's really helped me to understand. I hope it does the same for you. How are people making decisions on some of these things then in life? What do they believe about life, about humanity, about purpose? I'm going to suggest that the dominant lens in Western society is this secular worldview, and it's how they approach it. It celebrates scientific approach to knowledge. So reliable knowledge really is only there when we have tested it and we've measured it and we've scientifically proven it. Then we know we've got a fact for sure. And it's familiar, isn't it? That's kind of how we teach our kids. It's a concrete thing. It's something we can really get hold of because it's a fact. Okay, so that kind of makes sense. But where does that leave us when we come to values? How do we measure a value and how do we scientifically prove it? There isn't really anywhere to go with that when you look at the world and life and humanity through that lens. There's nowhere to measure those things. So it must be based on personal opinion and preference, mustn't it? That's what this worldview would say. It's right for you, but it's not right for me. It's true for you, but it's not true for me. And actually, that's the real difference. Facts and values are valued differently. They're seen differently. It makes truth, morality, these ethical debates, right and wrong, really relative and very fluid. And you can change your mind in a given situation, or who you're with, or a previous experience that you've had. So justice, morals, truth, these things, they're not fixed anymore. And so we have no plumb line with this worldview as to what is right and wrong. It sounds embracing. It sounds lovely. It sounds like I'm really accepting of you. It's not right for you, but it's right for me. But I'll accept you, whatever your opinion is. There's no absolute right or wrong, because we're really all about freedom for people to be able to express themselves, aren't we? Are we? But it dupes us into thinking that a life without absolute rights and wrongs and absolute truth means a life without restrictions, a life of freedom. But actually it doesn't, because somewhere along the line, someone's going to disagree with each other's opinion. And who wins out then? So there's a mass of opinions out there. And actually it becomes quite selfish. It sounds embracing, but it becomes, well, this is my opinion and you won't tell me that it's wrong. Imagine a football match, and this is just for the lads. Imagine a football match without any rules. So the ref turns up. The rules are, there are no rules. So there's no start time, there's no finish time. You might score, but then the other team might say, no, you didn't. So we can't keep a record of that either. And then you might want to swap teams anyway. So I'm not playing with you now, I'm going to play with them. And there was a foul there. No, there wasn't a foul. There definitely wasn't a foul. It's chaos, isn't it? And that makes sense to you guys, doesn't it? Sure. So this lens is actually really, really unhelpful, but it's how the world, the secular world, sorry, the Western world is approaching some of these decisions. So we can't all be right. People will be hurt and some people will be ignored. And actually it begins to break people. If you think about abortion, what's the right and loving thing to do, and a multitude of opinions, and you might consider one person's opinion more important than another, but someone's getting hurt along the way, aren't they? So the lens is flawed, but it's still applauded. And then finally, what is it to be a person? So when we look at that through this lens, it's actually called personhood theory. So it's argued that what it is to be a person is found in their ability to think, to reason, to judge things, to self-determine. And actually, when you think about what we've just said, that really makes sense, because I need to be able to judge and value things for myself. So when you lose that ability, when the mind is less able, does that make you less valuable? Slippery, isn't it? So when you consider the things we thought of, it does begin to make sense. It devalues the body, the physical body, and it elevates the importance of the mind and the self-determination. So importantly, looking at the morally tricky questions, in these situations like embryo research or abortion or even euthanasia, you have got a body, or at least the beginnings of a person, but you've either got a mind that's not yet fully developed, thanks Purdy, or a mind that's deteriorating. And in the extreme of what I've read, people would even say that, well, we can't class that as a person then. It's really slippery. It's all about value. It's skewed and it's dangerous. So, moving on to the Bible. We've got a few verses coming up, actually. What does the Bible say? And loads of these verses have been quoted this morning already, so I'm really encouraged because you're all on the same page as me. What does it say about how we view the world around us, what rights and wrongs are? And God does give us some absolutes. And he gives us some order instead of chaos. And he gives us freedom to flourish alongside each other, rather than this kind of pretend freedom that's out there. So the Bible was written way before lots of these medical advances. It doesn't use any of these terms and things that we're talking about today. But we still believe as Christians, it speaks right into the heart of these issues. So it will give us some equipping and some understanding and some wisdom to be able to approach it, and principles. Follow these in your Bible if you want to, but I've put them all up on the screen. Dave reminded us last week, and a few others actually over the course of this series, in Genesis 2, God created man out of the dust and he breathed life into him. He created humanity, a body and a mind. And Jeremiah is really clear that that God is the author of life. Before I formed you in the womb, God says, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. Created, designed, formed with care, given attention and detail. It's amazing, isn't it? You're valuable. And it's reflected in David's words in Psalm 139. And thanks to Ben, we've heard that this morning. I'm going to read it again. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. It's detail. It's no accident. It refers to, David refers to himself as a person, even before his body was formed. Job went through loads of struggles, didn't he? I don't want a life like Job. But even Job, in the middle of his suffering, he acknowledges God's hand on him. Your hand shaped me and made me. You moulded me like clay. You clothed me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bone and sinew. Full acknowledgement of God's work of creation, creating a new human. Now we know life is from God. We've established that from what we've read. But he also knows our beginning and our end. So Job goes on to say, a person's days are determined. You've decreed the number of months and you've set limits that he can't exceed. The beginning and the end, all of it valuable. And in Matthew, when Jesus is talking to his disciples, he himself says, what is the price of two sparrows? One copper coin. But not a single sparrow will fall to the ground without your father knowing it. Even something as invaluable as a sparrow, he sees. And even the hairs on your head are numbered. So don't be afraid. You're worth far more than many sparrows. We're precious. We're valued. We're known. We're watched over. He sees the beginning right through to the end. And then this is my favourite, and Matt stole my thunder. But we're God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which he prepared in advance for us to do. He also gives us purpose. He doesn't just make us. He doesn't just see the end and the beginning. He gives us purpose. Every moment precious. While you're young, while you're old, when you're well, when you're sick, there's purpose. And we have to trust that. And in Ephesians, we're encouraged to be children of light, God's design for us to flourish, shining light in the dark and leading others ultimately to know him. So we've got a pair of glasses again, I think. Unlike the secular worldview, we can see that the Bible worldview is completely unselfish. We're made for good works that demonstrate him to other people. We're urged loads of times throughout the Bible to protect the weak, look after the needy, look out for the vulnerable. That's what we're all about. That's how we give dignity to someone. There is a plumb line where there wasn't previously with the other worldview. There are some absolutes, there are some facts, and there are values for us there. Probably the most common one we think of when we think about facts and things is Ten Commandments. So instead of limiting us, these facts and boundaries and values, they actually give us freedom for abundant life to flourish alongside each other. Is that making some sense? Okay, so there's value in every human being. Okay, so let's go on to our response then. So, bumping into grace. That's what it should all be about. We've considered some lenses in the world around us and how we see it. And we've seen that the biblical worldview is advantageous for the whole of humanity, encompasses everyone, even the needy. And so the key question really is, how are we going to respond? And I want to suggest three ways. But first of all, I want to read you a story. Settle back. The north wind boasted of great strength. The sun argued, there's great power in gentleness. We'll have a contest, said the sun. Far below, a man travelled a winding road. He was wearing a warm winter coat. As a test of strength, said the sun, let's see which of us can take the coat off that man. It'll be quite simple for me, said the wind, bragging. I'll force him to remove his coat. The wind blew so hard, the birds clung to the trees and the world was filled with dust and leaves. But the harder the wind blew down the road, the tighter the shivering man held his coat around his body. Then the sun came out from behind a cloud. The sun warmed the air and the frosty ground, and the man on the road unbuttoned his coat. The sun grew slowly brighter and brighter, and soon the man felt so hot he took off his coat and sat down in a shady spot. How did you do that? Said the wind. It was easy, said the sun. I lit the day and through gentleness showed my strength. It's Aesop's fable. You've probably heard it before. I love it. I use it all the time because for me, it just is a visual image of how we should be. You've heard it said a few times over this last series, grace first, then truth. And that's really what that story is all about. When Jesus met people, this is what he modelled. When he met Zacchaeus, I'll come to your house, Zacchaeus. That wasn't deserved, was it? That was undeserved favour. When he met the woman at the well, he talked to her, he engaged her, he gave her a little task to do for him, he valued her. That was undeserved favour. She was ostracised. The adulterous woman, we know that story too, don't we? And Jesus reaches out to her first. And he does challenge. He does challenge with the truth. Go and don't sin anymore. Move away from your previous way of life. But the first thing that people meet, the first thing they bump into, is grace. Jesus does allow them choice, though. And we must be the same. We must allow people to choose for themselves. I am an evangelist at heart. I love seeing the heart, the lights flicker on when people begin to understand a little bit about the kingdom of God, who Jesus is. And it does give me a real buzz to extend grace. Kind of, I don't know why, but it just gives me that buzz feeling. It's something that's undeserved and I'm going to give it you anyway. But I know the challenge. And when I've challenged someone too hard, when I've begun to use words and they begin to wrap their own ideas more tightly around themselves, I can see that I've just overstepped it a little bit. It's in the body language, isn't it? You've all seen that. When someone feels threatened now by what I'm saying, maybe a bit crossed by what I'm saying, like I don't really understand their backstory yet, I haven't really got any right to be saying these things because you don't know me and you don't know what I've been through. And it's that moment when they're wrapping their coats tightly around themselves, aren't they? You've got to balance it carefully because we have got to speak, but at the right time and in the right way. And I'm going to say something maybe a little contentious now. I've got to admit, I struggle when I see really vocal protests, for instance, outside an abortion clinic. I know it's really well-intentioned. I know it's Christians trying to speak truth into the world around them. But what actually happens is people who have to walk by feel very judged on their behaviour rather than on their value. They begin to wrap their own ideas around them a bit more tightly. And actually, they begin to form ideas of what Christians think about them. And it's not always good. So I struggle with that. Now, you might not, but I'm just saying that's what I struggle with. I'm going to tell you a little moment. I remember a lady, 40-plus-year-old lady, who came along to our emergency gynae room, not in Worcester, this is some time ago. She was very angry, and she plonked on the chair, she took the clipboard, and she angrily filled it in, and she angrily handed it back, and everyone knew she was angry. She didn't want to be there. I went back into the office, and a few minutes later, there was a knock on the office door. I'm not waiting here. I'm not waiting here. Have you got somewhere else to come? I'm not listening to those screaming kids. And she was really uptight. And I said, oh, okay. And the eyes brimmed with tears. And I just had time that day, and I don't always, as Dawn will bear with me, I just had time that day to say, should we go and try and find somewhere? Maybe we can find a drink as well. So off we wandered. We found a side room and we sat down together and made a drink. And in that moment, she then unpacked some of her story. What brought you here today? And it all came out. It was complicated. It was messy. There was lots of poor decisions along the way that you think, oh gosh, why? But they were decisions that had been made. And she was living with the consequences, and she didn't need me to get involved in telling her, might have been better to do something different there. She was already struggling. So after the tears had subsided and she talked for some time, we drained our cups. I eventually said to her, tell me about your family, who's at home? And so she began to tell me she lived nearby, what she did for work. And then she started talking about her children. She had three children. She told me who they were, where they went to school, what they liked to do, what they were good at. And that's when the dam bust. And she just sobbed. I can't do this. I don't even agree with abortion myself. I just can't do this. But I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I don't want everyone to know. And so then we talked about some pregnancy crisis counselling, and she went on her way eventually. Now, I'm not telling you that to show off. I'm certainly not. And I'm not telling you that all situations are like that, because they're certainly not, and often don't have that kind of time. But that story was amazing. It was a moment for me. And all I did was ask a question. Didn't give her any information. I asked a question, and with the answer, she reminded herself how precious life was. She thought about her own kids, and it all started with a pregnancy like this. That's what grace looks like, guys. Bumping into grace. And the coat came off in the warmth of a bit of time spent with someone, allowing someone just to tell a bit of the backstory. I did used to come home often from that unit feeling, am I doing the right thing? It's morally messy. Should I even be working there? It's uncomfortable. It really is uncomfortable. People making decisions that you don't necessarily agree with. But people make their choices. But Jesus was in those morally messy situations, wasn't he? He spent time with people who made decisions that weren't going to be good for them. And he gave them respect, he gave them care, he gave them dignity, and that's what we're called to do. He even said, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. So it's where we need to be, isn't it? Mother Teresa said, not everyone can do great things, but everyone can do small things with great kindness. Got it on my fridge at home because I just absolutely love it. I can't do great things, but I can do something small. And it'll have an impact. That's what grace looks like. What was Jesus like? In Matthew, Jesus is chatting to Peter. And Peter comes and says to him, Jesus, how many times have I got to forgive? Like seven times. He's obviously struggling, isn't he? He's extended some kind of grace to someone and he's found it either thrown back in his face, or he's found it harder to keep on extending grace when it keeps going on and on and on. Or maybe he's finding that his grace has been misunderstood, that some people are accusing him of condoning someone's choices and behaviour. So he's struggling. And Jesus says, not seven, like 70 times seven. It's boundless. It's boundless. It never runs out. That's why we're so happy. It never runs out. His forgiveness never runs out. His grace over us never runs out. His mercy never runs out. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for your grace and mercy in my life. It surprises people when they bump into grace with us. And it should surprise them. And we might be misunderstood. Take it on the chin. It's what Jesus did. And we're called to be his ambassadors. John Piper says, the gospel teaches us how to live. But it also rescues us when we fail to live the way we're supposed to. That's the gospel of Jesus. Hope, forgiveness, a future. It's amazing. And that kind of grace wraps around people better than any coat that they can have. Okay. Our second response is that we can tell a better story. Some of you might have heard that title from a book. It's a great book if you get to read it. I'll put some pictures up later. Tell a better story. Who doesn't love a good story? Good ones bear repeating, don't they? I've watched a better story unfold this last year, a bit longer actually. I've watched a little baby boy with no hope of a stable home, definitely no hope of safety, come into a family and be loved, cared for, blessed. His whole future's changed, and it's impacted the family as well. It's a two-way thing. There's a future. There's a hope that he might get to know who Jesus is too. It'll be in that home. That family tell a better story from personal experience. That's what I mean by a better story. God's way for human flourishing. But we as a church family too, we've grown in knowledge about adoption and fostering. We know now from first-hand experience, it's a good, it's a healthy choice. It's a loving choice. And we speak that story now with conviction because we've seen it happen. I'm not saying it always goes 100% well. I know that. I'm not that idealistic. But we can tell this story with conviction. It's a good option. Anne was in her 50s when she approached me to see whether there's something we could do about the teenage pregnancy crisis that was going on in the area that we lived at the time. The stats had shot up and I was working in the hospital. Was there anything that we could do to maybe link up some kind of counselling that the hospital had sadly had to close down because we didn't have funding for it? Over the next 2 years, she pioneered a work to become a crisis pregnancy care confidential. Some of you might have heard of CARE, a pregnancy service. Around eight, took a year-long course to become counsellors, so crisis pregnancy counsellors and post-abortion counsellors. Our crisis pregnancy counselling wasn't Christian in a sense. It was unbiased. It was space. And our post-abortion counselling was Christian counselling, and people knew that when they came for it. We took it in turns to open a little room above a shop on a Saturday morning, and it was never convenient. It always came on the wrong Saturday. These things always do, don't they? But that's when you've got to push through, because you know you're doing something to push back with a better story. And we shared with men and women, a lot of the time over the phone actually, but sometimes face-to-face too, confidential, unbiased information, time to talk, come and tell me your backstory, come and work out why you're finding this such a tricky issue to come to terms with. What's going on in your heart as opposed to what's going on in your head, where your head's telling you you've got no choices, but in your heart you're worried about what will happen if I make this decision. That's unfold some of that a little bit. Some we don't know what happened, of course. We prayed for them. That was another part of what we did. We prayed for them. We prayed for those unborn children. Some went on to choose abortion as an option. Very few went on to choose adoption or fostering. Of those that chose abortion, a high percentage, and I haven't got numbers, but a high percentage came back for post-termination counselling, post-abortion, I should say. Sometimes months later, and sometimes twice, because months later it wasn't sort of too far enough away, so they had to return maybe a year later. But they came back to the place where they'd bumped into grace, where they'd received a welcome, where they'd been given time and space. And often asked for the person that they'd met the first time by name. They'd built up that rapport and trust. It's a better story. It's showing real, genuine care and concern, not dependent on someone's behaviour, not dependent on someone's choice, but something that shows acceptance and love and help for recovery. And that's what Jesus is all about. A new start, forgiveness, hope, healing, forgiveness. Okay. We can't keep on telling the same story of God's plan and ideal for our flourishing in the same way as we have, because we're just going to keep getting the same results. What do I mean by that? People have often heard everything that we're not for. We're not for abortion. We're not for euthanasia. We're not for pornography. We're not for drunkenness and immorality. Of course we're not. I'm not disagreeing with those things. Absolutely not. They're not healthy choices. They're going to damage you, and they will damage other people around you too. Absolutely. But it's more about the way we've communicated these things. Sometimes, dare I say, we've appeared judgmental to the point that we've alienated people. Please don't feel I'm judging you by saying this. I'm just trying to take the lid off the can. Sometimes we've challenged people so much that they feel like we're totally uncaring and don't have any compassion at all. Sometimes it's just been about pushing our point. I need you to hear what I'm going to say. Sometimes we've come across as superior and hypocritical. We've got to take time to stop and to listen and to hear people's stories, the nuances of what's going on in people's lives, and then individualise a better story. A story of grace first and truth. The Creator's way, his design over us to flourish. And this is a story that's often told over time. It's not necessarily something that you'll mention at that crisis point. It's something that we have to live out over time and people see. And when they've seen it, it's you that they will come to. Not because you're important, but because they've seen the outcome of your life. They've seen how it works. Lynn Harrison, this Better Story book, he says you need to take a bit of criticism on the chin. And I agree with him. I think we need to be a bit broader shouldered. I'm not saying we can't talk openly about these things, but we've got to find ways for people to not feel threatened or judged in how we present stuff. So I'm just going to suggest it's better on a one-to-one or one with a couple rather than on a platform. It's better when they've bumped into your grace first and you've built a rapport and then they invite you in to speak. And then the final challenge is sometimes you've been invited in to speak. Me too. And we haven't been brave enough to speak. You've got to be prepared to give an answer. So sometimes they've asked you and you've got to take the plunge. What's God's design over? My Josh said to me last night, we were talking about this, and he said, yeah, it's that verse, it's that phrase, isn't it? People don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. I was like, oh yeah, I'll put that in. It's true, isn't it? They want to know you care first. That's what I want to know. Finally, we're so nearly there, I promise you. We've got to be a bilingual people. We've got to learn to speak both languages, and that's what I've tried to do today, is to take the lid off a little bit. How are most people approaching these issues? It's a different language. They don't think about it how we do. And you've got to get inside that way of thinking to be able to appeal. How are people approaching life and morals and humanity? Why do they think the way that they do? What does the Bible say? Karl Barth said, take your Bible and your newspaper and read both, but interpret newspapers from your Bible. We've got to be engaged, haven't we? We live in the world. We've got to know what's going on in the world around us. We've got to engage with society and the issues they face. We should know the headlines, especially these moral maze headlines. We've got to be prepared, though, to spill grace wherever we go and give an answer when we're invited to. So I'm just going to suggest three simple things very, very quickly. Number one, we can pray for Christians in these workplaces. There's loads of people in these workplaces. Please, please pray for them, that they'll get those moments occasionally, and that when the moments aren't elongated, that somehow they're able to spill a bit of grace in those situations. Number two, and we've got a slide with loads of books coming up, equip yourself. Learn. Listen, read, there's podcasts, there's books galore. These books are off, Christian Medical Fellowship. I've forgotten my words now. But there's loads of books there. In fact, two of them I've used a lot, Love Thy Body and A Better Story. I've used a lot in this talk, but there's lots and lots of things to read if you're interested in this. And even if you're not, try and find something that will just give you the headlines. Get informed. And then, so equip yourself. And number three is get informed. Find out who's doing what. So the Christian Medical Fellowship, Care Not Killing, Care, Youth for Christ in schools and their resources. There's loads of really good organisations that are doing stuff. Find out what they're doing, get their newsletters and see how you can get involved. This is where the platform speaking comes in, rather than to groups of individual people. We've got a platform here with schools, with media, with government, medical societies. This is the space for the group voice. So we contribute to debates, we vote in the polls, we engage with our MPs, and this, as I say, is more of a platform space. Okay, that's all I've got to say today. I know it's been a huge topic. I hope it's been helpful. We've looked at loads of big issues over these last few weeks, lots and lots of information. And really, ultimately for us, it's about being able to share God's grace with people and his truth. May God bless us as we try to do that.